Hi friends, happy Friday. Hope you're all doing well. I know we took a week's break from our podcast series, but I've been so busy the past couple of weeks. My mom is visiting from the Philippines, nursing work was so busy, social media work was so busy, and I just needed a breather from all the editing and preparation I allowed for the podcast. Though, please believe me when I say that I still love you all. I just needed a rest, and I took it because I believe that it's so important to listen to what your mind and body need. If we need rest, we should take it. If we need a mental health day, we should definitely take it. I, for sure, still have to remind myself of this constantly. Sometimes I feel guilty resting or not doing anything, though I know I shouldn't. I think our society has wired our brains to be pure work and hustle, but sometimes we just need to slow down, rest, and take a break. Especially as an Asian American, this type of constant work mindset and behavior has been instilled in me since a child, and I know all my fellow Asians can understand and relate. I am nitpicking on my heritage specifically because this is the crux of today's podcast episode, Asian mental health, a concept that you may call an irony generations ago because they were once antithesis. It's sad to say, but it is only recently that we have seen Asians more open to the conversation about mental health and seeking help. And even now, we still see a lot of stigma and sensitivity to these ideas. In fact, data from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration shows that in 2021, 25% of Asian American adults with a mental illness reported receiving mental health services, compared to 52% of white adults. Another data shows that the Asians were 2.25 times more likely to report mental health treatments as ineffective. What is it about the Asian and Asian American community that our approachability in response to mental health and mental health care is lower than other demographics? Is it mistrust? Is it disbelief in the services themselves? Or can it be fear and shame to partake in these conversations and actually receive help? As an Asian American myself, I know firsthand the stigma and taboo placed on these discussions about raw emotions of hurt and grief, mental illnesses, seeking professional help, and just going against the grain in such a collectivist culture. I think being a nurse and having patients of Asian descent also have shown me the grander picture of how mental health is truly such a taboo topic in their community. Or just being a son to an Asian parent. Is it a universal Asian experience that our parents cut off fruits for us instead of saying sorry after a fight? Well, in today's episode, I am so honored to introduce you to three dear friends who tackle this concept and this reality of mental health and mental health care for our Asian community. We talk about it all. Racism and microaggression, intergenerational trauma, raw emotions of grief and hurt and anger and pain, the model minority myth, and so much more. Carrie Zhang is the founder of the Asian Mental Health Project, a nonprofit organization that provides educational resources and community care initiatives to help destigmatize mental health and make it more accessible for the Pan-Asian community through social media, multimedia content creation, and community events. And we have Ali Zhang, CEO, and Nisha Desai, COO, the co-founders of Annie's Health, an online holistic mental health service for the Asian community that incorporates cultural stressors into personalized treatments. Alice and Nisha were co-pupils at Harvard Business School for their MBA, where they saw and agreed on the importance of culturally responsive providers and an integrated approach to executing data-driven treatment for Asian clients. Today's topic is so important to me, and I hope to you too. I hope you get to learn a lot of things, that our hearts are softened and our eyes are opened to these conversations. Ever since I was a child, my inner arms and neck would always suffer from itchiness and irritation whenever I would sweat. It can become so debilitating, forcing myself not to scratch my skin and end up with wounds from prickly heat, especially at night. Thankfully, I have found relief through By Dr. Mom's Soothing Beta Cream and Soothing Bad Treatment, which uses barley-derived beta-glucan technology to help alleviate eczema, bug bites, and dry, itchy, irritated skin. Beta-glucan is a fiber shown in scientific studies to improve skin hydration and healing, and By Dr. Mom's products extract it with a technique that uses air technology, requiring no chemicals or solvents. Created by family physician Dr. Stephanie Liu with the help of an allergist and immunologist, you can now allow your skin to breathe and heal naturally. Using the code CHRISTIAN10, that's CHRISTIAN10, you can get 10% off your first order on buydrmom.com.
As a healthcare worker, my identity can become so boxed within the pressures and expectations of my profession that sometimes I forget who I really am outside the hospital walls. This is why I find so much power in liberation and self-expression through fashion and accessories. And Lupin seeks to do the same. Encouraging self-confidence and creating a safe space to be yourself, Lupin seeks to share with the world simple and impactful jewelry pieces that can bring confidence effortlessly. Meaning what goes around comes around, the brand, comprised of third-generation jewelers, holds a mission to brighten the community by promoting positivity and a growth mindset. Lupin's clean designs are handcrafted in South Korea using 925 sterling silver and can go with almost any outfit on anyone. In fact, I wear my pieces on and off shift. With the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ, you can get 15% off your first order on lupin.com. Let's bring more luster into the world, together with Lupin. I remember coming home every day from elementary school and smelling the newly steamed jasmine rice in the cooker that my grandmother made just in time for dinner. It reminded me of my first few years living on the farm back home in Asia, sniffing the rice while overlooking the fields. Founded in 2020, Bison Candle Co. hand-pours nostalgic and iconic scented soy wax candles inspired by the Asian scents, flavors, and traditions that founder Brandon Leung grew up with in his first-generation Chinese-American household. Brandon's mission with Bison is to create authentic Asian aromas while rediscovering his love of his Chinese culture and heritage. The candles and home fragrances celebrate aromatic Eastern flavors and aromas one would typically find in an Asian kitchen or pantry, like Vietnamese coffee, steamed white rice, and white peach. Enjoy traditional scents alongside some modern spin-off blends and be taken back into the beauty of the motherland with the code BISUNFRANZ, that's BAISUNFRANZ, for 15% off your first order at bisoncandleco.com.
Hello!
Hello! How's it going?
I'm good, Carrie. It's so nice to finally see you again virtually. I know that we bumped to each other in LA, like, I think that was around May, right? During the event?
Yeah! Oh my gosh, AAPI Heritage Month was, it's the best of times, it's the worst of times.
It is the busiest of times. I think it took me until now to recover from AAPI Month.
We're in August already. I'm so tired.
I know. But I know you just got off a meeting.
Yes.
So thank you so much for joining me today. If you could just first please introduce yourself to everybody who may not know.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. My name is Carrie. I am the founder and executive director of the Asian Mental Health Project. And I'm really, really excited to be here.
Yes, yes. You know, I first heard about Carrie and the Asian Mental Health Project because they did a collaboration with Clove, I think, a couple of years ago. And Clara, who's a dear friend of mine. And so just an introduction. I started this IG Live series turned podcast series in the beginning, mostly for clinicians, given that I'm a nurse myself, and talking about misinformation within healthcare. And then I realized, wait, there's so much more to just misinformation in healthcare, right? There's misinformation everywhere. And I think misinformation and costs a lot of lives and costs a lot of emotions, right? So over time, I started realizing, wait, we have to talk about mental health, which is such an important topic. And you do a great job of this, and specifically for our community, right? For Asian Americans and also Pacific Islanders. I wanted to first know, like, why is mental health so important to you that it led you to creating Asian Mental Health Project?
Yeah, thank you so much for, you know, having this. Firstly, like, I think your Friends of Friends podcast is so good, and I'm just really grateful to be here. But I mean, why it is so important to me is because, you know, mental health is something we live through every single day. As so long as you are, you know, a living, breathing creature, you are dealing with mental health on a day-to-day basis. So it's very important to me because the particular highlight around it of Asian mental health is particular to me because, you know, there's such a stigma around mental health care and mental health as a general topic in when I grew up. And I didn't grow up being able to talk about mental health. And I think as I grew up and grew older and did receive mental health care, I realized so much of it had to do with the way that I was raised and, you know, our upbringing and childhood experience, which is undoubtedly informed by the lens of being Asian American in my case. So I think that's why it's so important to have that culturally specific lens of care there. And yeah.
Yeah, super agree with all of that. I love what you said, that as long as you're a living, breathing human being, you know, mental health is something that affects all of us and something that should be talked about by everyone, right? But I also love what you said, the specific lens, right, when it comes to Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. There's definitely, when it comes to mental health and experiences and trauma and all of those conversations, there's something that's also culturally specific, like you mentioned, and race-based, right? For our community, do you think that there are actual mental health concerns or experiences that can lead to trauma that are very specific to our community?
Yes, I think the studies right now are still very, you know, early on and sparse, because I feel like the field of mental health has, you know, previously been very, like, you know, it's a very Western perspective of things. And I think recently, and not to say that these studies haven't existed, but our studies around correlation between, you know, racism as a collective trauma and mental health, as well as, you know, the impact of like colonialism and, you know, the impact of, you know, the high pressure upbringing that a lot of Asian folks have, whether it is the, you know, culture of work, you know, that, you know, adds a lot of pressure to, you know, Asian folks, which is, you know, of course, then brought overseas. There's, you know, the concept of like the model minority myth and things like that. You know, these are all sort of larger systems that impact the individual. It's called the ecological systems model, which calls to question of like, you as an individual are impacted by, you know, microsystems, macrosystems, all these sorts of things, whether it is your immediate family, and then what informs the family structure, well, that is, you know, overall societal norms, policies, and things like that. What informs that is, you know, the, you know, maybe globalized views of things. And, you know, there's just so much to unpack. And it's important to acknowledge that your mental health is impacted by the system in which you live, and ecosystem in which you live. So like things like climate that impact certain different regions can also impact you as an individual. Like, yeah, there's a lot to unpack there, but I hope that answers the question.
Yes, definitely. I mean, you brought up so many great points and so many topics that, well, it's not really talked about, right? I attended an event, a beautiful event this Sunday in New York City, Creating Space, which was just, I think until now, I'm like really trying to let it all settle down with how beautiful it is. It was basically moderated by Dr. Jenny Wang, who's a psychologist, and Rebecca was one of the organizers, who you know, and who I love. And, you know, one of the great things that Dr. Wang said right at the start of the event was, it was held in Barclays Center, and there's like so many Asians just sitting down to talk about mental health, right? Dr. Jenny Wang, in the very beginning of the event, she was like, I want you all to like let this moment seep in, just look around you. And she was like, think of the, was there ever a time in your life where you saw so many Asian Americans, so many Asians in one place sitting down to talk about mental health? And honestly, that gave me goosebumps, because when I thought about it, I was like, wait, I don't think we've ever had this happen, right? And it brings up the greater talk and issue or concept or whatever you may call it, of there's something about the Asian American community where mental health is not really talk about, right? We can call it, I don't know, taboo, or as you said earlier, stigmatized. And, you know, when things are not talked about, when we don't have conversations about certain things, so much misinformation flourishes around it, right? So much shame and guilt flourish from that, right? It's like a fountain of so many things. And hi to Rebecca joining. We're just talking about you. Anyways, and we've seen this throughout generations of the Asian community, where parents will be like, we don't talk about those things, right? Or many great things were brought up during the event on Sunday, where you're like, it's just something that's not talked about. And I think this leads to the concept of trauma, right? And sometimes trauma comes from just things being repressed and not talked about, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that if you go on TikTok, one of the biggest topics right now amongst the Asian community is the concept of generational trauma. Yeah. Right, for you, what does this concept mean, and how does it manifest, I guess, when you're talking about generations and the younger generation, our generation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you bring up several really great points, and you know, that, you know, all these things do contribute to what we call trauma, and trauma is, you know, some sort of significant impact that affects your life, and in this framework affects your mental health. The concept of generational trauma, and I do want to preface this by saying I'm not a mental health professional myself. I've just studied this through my work and things like that. But, you know, generational trauma, the idea is that trauma is passed across generations. So something that your great-grandmother went through, whether it is through genetics, which there's a concept called epigenetics, meaning that trauma changes your DNA, changes the way that your body processes things. Like there's real like neurological, physical impacts of trauma, whether it is physical trauma or emotional trauma or, you know, somewhere along those lines. And then it's passed forward through DNA. And along with that, there's also, you know, cultural expectations and familial ways that, you know, you were raised and taught that gets passed forward during generations, whether it's through tradition and or culture or genetics. You know, there is generational impact, which in turn can be generational trauma there. The way that, you know, it comes up in conversation with mental health today is like there's a lot of desire to sort of unlearn these what we call like generational trauma, generational cycles and things like that, because, you know, just as much as trauma can be passed down, it can also be reprogrammed. You know, you can reprogram your DNA to be able to respond and heal from this trauma, which, you know, takes a lot of work, I would like to say, you know. And I feel like what is so special about this generation, and I love that you're saying like this is the first time this stuff is happening in a lot of ways, and it's very exciting but very scary because there can be a lot of misinformation, but we do have to start somewhere. And I feel very grateful to be in a generation where, you know, these conversations are starting to happen. The concept of unpacking, you know, how trauma is passed down is currently being studied, and in turn we can learn how to heal from that, from those points as well. So, you know, it's twofold. It's important to understand the impact of trauma and understand, you know, how you got here today. That's always like the main question that we try to answer with Asian Mental Health Project is how did I get here? Like what systems brought me here? How did my family, like what happened so that I became, why am I the way that I am, basically? And then what can we learn from that to create, you know, collective healing or individual healing from that as well. Yeah, I feel like generational trauma and generational, you know, cycles and impact is such a popular topic for Asian folks too, especially because I think culturally we are expected to honor our ancestral roots and things like that. There's just so much of that. And that can bring great pressure and expectation and stigma of like, oh, you know, I feel like many of us probably heard folks who came from immigrant families of like, we didn't come all the way here. Like your grandpa didn't, you know, suffer X, Y, and Z just so you could get a B on this test.
50 miles to go to school.
Oh my God, I know. I was like, does everybody have this story? My dad's always like, I rode a donkey and I went over mountains to go to school. And I was like, true, but like, I have no proof. And I'm like,
my mom was like, I walked through rivers to go to elementary school. I was like, oh, you walked. Okay, Jesus.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, that's not to dismiss that, but you know, that sort of like those teachings are passed down, and that's, you know, generational, those are generational cycles, generational trauma that's passed down. So yeah, great question.
Yeah. I love your answer to that. And I think one of the best things that you said is trying to, one, not just unpack all of it, but trying to like break a cycle, right? Mm-hmm. You know, sad boy seasons, there's memes on Facebook where they're like, oh, trust takes a long time to get built, but so quick to break it down, right? I feel like it's kind of that mood, right? Where trauma can be easily brought upon a person, especially in our community, right? Because it's so collective. It's like, so contagious, right? Whatever we feel inside is like felt throughout everybody, and someone's experience, no matter how different it is, even though I didn't have to walk through rivers to go to elementary school, right? Like all of those things are passed down, and you're right, expectations are set, comparison of, I guess, hardships and difficulties are also set there, right? And I think the next step is really trying to unpack all of that and breaking that cycle, which again, it's not easy at all, right? It took generations to build these things up. It's not going to be easy to also unpack and break all of these cycles. And I guess that's what Asian Mental Health Project seeks to do, right? It's to educate about it, right? And to advocate for people. Well, I wanted to know, being the founder and the executive behind it, when did you start Asian Mental Health Project? And what was your reason for creating such an amazing community?
Thank you. That's very kind. I started this in around, officially it started 2019. 2018 actually is when the first idea came about. And the reason why I started it, quite frankly, is because I was feeling really lost and like lonely. I myself had gone through a traumatic event that essentially sent me into the mental health care through college. And it was then that I realized that, you know, I had anxiety and PTSD and things like that, that still like, impact me to this day. But, you know, after going, like, I did not want to go to therapy. Like, I was not ready for it. I did, like, therapy, I, you know, went through, like, psychotherapy analysis and also just, like, medication and things. I did support groups. And it was just, like, a lot of mental health care all at once for someone who, like, truly didn't believe in it back in the day. Like, there's stigma, yes, but it's also because it's called like mental health. There's the belief that, you know, you can power through and control it all when really it's okay to receive that kind of support. So after having gone through that in college, I graduated and I was like, holy crap. Like, I feel like a lot of what I had gone through and what my friends have gone through who are also, you know, identify as Asian, perhaps could have been mitigated earlier had we had like the tools and vocabulary to discuss mental health. And so I sort of set up on a, like a little bit of a search of like, I can't be the only person who's experiencing this. I know I'm not. So let me just ask people. So I like put up an Instagram post of like, hey, I want to do this like multimedia project around mental health. Would anybody be interested in talking to me? And again, by then it was very like fresh. So it caught wind a lot. And I got to talk to, I think like over 60 individuals. I like interviewed them talking about their experiences with mental health as Asian folks. And everybody had very different individual stories, but like very similar key themes. Everybody struggled with high stress, low self-esteem, people pleasing, anxiety or anxious tendencies and things like that, which are all again interconnected. A lot of like, yeah, like self-loathing, which was very, very interesting to me. And I was like, wow, we all identify very differently, but we all experience these same sorts of values and therefore impact of mental health conditions. So from then it became like an Instagram account where I just like posted what I learned. And then the pandemic hit and it was so scary being those beginning moments of the pandemic. And even now, not only was, you know, were we all isolated, not only was this like mysterious disease, like going through, you know, the world, you know, Asian folks were being blamed for it. There was so much xenophobia and I really realized we needed a place to sort of turn inward and unpack with one another. So we started offering these virtual like peer-to-peer wellness groups. Which we still have to this day. We have weekly wellness check-ins, which are just, you know, peer-run groups that unpack, you know, certain topics such as intergenerational trauma. We try to bring in a mental health professional or wellness practitioner for those weekly wellness check-ins. And, you know, we've opened many groups since then. But it was really at the beginning just like a virtual space for us to all sit together and talk about what it was like to be Asian in, you know, wherever you're at. Mm-hmm. It's open to anyone across the globe. And that just like built so much community. And it made me realize we as people need to gather, we as people in order to heal, you know, we cannot do it in isolation. It kind of reminded the Carrie that started this, that felt very lonely, that, you know, healing is not in always just in individualized therapy or just, it's not all in your own head. You know, we need to come together as a community to provide resources for one another because that's really the only way we are going to survive. And so, yeah, so since then, Asian Mental Health Project has become a nonprofit organization, which is very exciting. Yay! We've been able to offer mental health funding for individuals, which we're going to launch again really soon. We now have, I think, 7 affinity groups, and then we do in-person events as well, and you know, hoping to expand more with partnerships and just what are my main focus is, you know, can we work together with, you know, folks who have the same mission of, you know, trying to provide accessible mental health resources. And right lately, I've been unpacking, you know, our 3 words are like to educate, empower, and advocate. And I've been really unpacking the word empower because I feel like that can be overused in a way or used in a way that's like not super intentional. So yeah. I'm trying to unpack that word of like, what does it mean to empower? And I think that means to get folks the resources and tools that they can in the most easy and accessible way so that they would be able to prioritize their own healing and community healing as well. So yeah. Not an answer. But
I love it. I love it. Yeah. I mean, I truly resonate with a lot of that. I mean, especially in high school, I was going through so much anxiety and also panic attacks. And in my mind, it's always that question, right? Is it just me? Am I the only one who's going through this? And it's really so powerful when you start to realize and see that you're not alone and that there's one, there's people who are going through the same thing. Two, that there are professionals who are trained, right, to help you get through those times. And three, that there are, especially now as opposed to years ago, there's a lot of resources specifically for your identity or the things that you go through. Like, as we said earlier, many experiences when it comes to mental health and trauma are very race specific or obviously community based as well, right? I wanted to share a tagline from your Instagram account, actually, of Asian Mental Health Project, where it says, making mental health more approachable. That's what I'm reading from the bio, right? And, you know, when we think of the word approachable, inherently what it's trying to say that there's some things that are not easy to approach, right? And I think that's so true for the Asian community is mental health sometimes is, I mean, unapproachable, right? There's a lot of barriers, there's a lot of chasms and gaps. What do you think for our community or, I guess, systemic, personal, or individualized chasm and barriers to mental health? And how does Asian Mental Health Project seeks to unite those divides?
Yeah. Oh my God. Firstly, that was an excellent and beautiful question. Thank you so much. Because approachability is really sort of where we, like, as you mentioned before, we focus on the education piece. You know, in simple terms, knowledge is power / knowledge is a tool for folks to aid their own healing. So, I mean, there are so many barriers to receiving mental health care. One, you know, the main sort of thing right now is, well, let's dial it back to stigma, like the barrier of like first even validating and approaching the desire and need for it is really difficult because, you know, even though it is being more talked about now, it is still a very scary and difficult thing because there is still a lot of shame attached to, oh, I need help. Like that's just like the basic thing, let alone I need help for my mental health problems and issues. Like that is a very scary thing. And the way to combat that, I think, is to normalize it more in just conversation, but also not just talking about it to no end, but providing, you know, resources that folks can pass along to others. I think something that, you know, we encourage is that everybody learn more about how to support your friends through mental health issues and crisis and things. How do I hold space? How do I communicate? And how do I create an environment that is empathetic and compassionate and nurturing? And I think that is like a very first step in destigmatizing things, is approaching with more empathy. So that's one. Financial barriers are a very large issue. You know, it is very expensive, and the way health insurance works in this country and the next, you know, like healthcare is an incredibly, I'm sure you know very well, a difficult thing to navigate. Like, it's not just being able to pay for it, but it's being able to have the tools to be able to understand how to pay for it. Like, if I don't even know how I'm going to pay for this, like, you know, it's so difficult. It's not straightforward. It's hard to say what the solution is to that in a way that, you know, because policy has so many layers to it. But, you know, one of the things is to talk about like what true options are there for accessible mental health care. Like there is therapy, which is great and, you know, could be very, very useful for folks. But there are also, you know, local community resources that, you know, are hopefully, like, my call to action for folks is, you're working in the spaces, is to get involved into those spaces and offer more community mental health care initiatives. It is to offer sort of peer support networks along with therapy, along with, you know, clinical psychology, all those things. Everything together, you know, contributes to mental health care, food, housing, things like that. Those are all things that impact our mental health and, you know, could use that community care and support there. But that being said, financial barriers are still very, very real and part of a larger, like, economic issue as well. And then, of course, I mean, I've covered financial, cultural, oh, and there's also like language barriers and things like that. I feel like particularly with Asian folks, a lot of us either are immigrants or come from immigrant families, or, you know, there's a lot of different ways that we can't communicate how we feel or can't communicate mental health because the vocabulary either doesn't exist or just hasn't been discussed. So there are a lot of language barriers and generational barriers too of, you know, how do we reach this sort of mutual understanding? There are, of course, you know, political barriers and things like that. There's just kind of a lot running against us there. And yes, and lots of, you know, we're in a mental health crisis right now, like truly, especially amongst youth, but also, you know, across several generations with our you know, senior generations as well. And so I feel like that there are a lot of barriers that, you know, just sort of prevent us from being able to seek mental health, especially as demand gets higher. You know, there are a lot of tools out there, but it's oftentimes not enough to meet the current, you know, need. So hopefully we are on a trajectory where mental health is more valued and therefore, you know, more resources are available. But right now we are at a bit of a resource deficit there. And, you know, it also calls into question like representation there. You know, I feel like I am so in awe of a lot of like Asian Mental Health Collective. They have a database that specifically synthesizes AAPI therapists. Now for like Psychology Today, Open Path Collective. These are all like resources of finding therapists. There are ways to filter through race and ethnicity and things like that, or like cultural background and specific needs. But at the same time, it's like, whoa, it really shows you like there's more that we need and we are on that path. And I just am so grateful to any like healthcare provider, a mental health provider, all these things for providing those resources. And, you know, there's such high demand that it's hard. Yeah. The resources are scarce. So yeah.
Yeah, super agree with all of that, that there's literally a lot against us, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I love you said the most is representation, right? Which has been, I think, echoing the past few years, right? I think as Asian hate crimes were going up, we're trying to combat that with the more representation, right? I want to share another thing from the event on Sunday. Like yeah. I said, Dr. Jenny Wang was the psychologist who's the moderator on stage. And during the Q&A portion, I think one of the audience was like, I'll be honest, it's the first time I've ever seen an Asian psychologist.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And it says a lot, right? Mm-hmm. We may not have the on-hand statistics when it comes to, I guess, the amount of Asian psychologists or mental health experts, right? I think it just goes to show that representation is needed and it's so important. I said this last time too during our live stream with our friends from Annie's Help, right, Nisha? I was saying how Viola Davis recently had a recent interview and someone asked her, why is representation so important? Like, why do we need to see people on screen who look like us or on books or whatever industry it may be? And Viola Davis said that representation is the physical manifestation of your dreams and your hopes. It's different just having a stereotype and an archetype. You need to see someone tangibly and viably and that you know for yourself that it can happen. And I think that's also transmissible to the concept and to the field of mental health, right? Is having Asian representatives, psychologists, mental health experts, or even those who are founders of amazing programs who give resources to the Asian community like yourself, right? And I think that's why it's also so important to keep the factors within the Asian community that, let's say, the whole collective, right? The Asian collective, the Asian community, as I've seen it online, it can be connotated in a bad way in the sense that because if it's such a community, anything you do wrong will reflect on the whole community, right? Like you always think, what will others think? What will others say of me? What will my community think of me, right? But I feel like we can also pick up that potentially negative connotation about the community to something so positive, right? It's using the community to build that mental health project, right? Hence your name. And I think this is what I love about your stay-in, check-in program, right, that you do for Asian Mental Health Project, which is, I believe, what you do, right, on a weekly basis. Is that correct? I wanted to focus on one of the days, which is the Proud Asian Men section.
Yeah.
Why do you think it was so important to have a session specifically for Asian men, or just conversations about Asian men in general?
Yeah, and thank you so much for calling in Proud Asian Men. That is one of the session that's very, very near and dear. That's one of our bi-weekly sessions led by the amazing Leo Xia, who is a wonderful organizer and artist and facilitator. I felt it important to have Proud Asian Men. So that was actually one of our first like affinity group, like specialty groups for a specific community that's not just the stay and check in. Because I think the way masculinity works in Asian communities is, and patriarchy works, it makes it very difficult for the men in our community to be able to talk about mental health. You know, I think from a sheer like numbers perspective, it's something like 70 to 80% of mental health providers are women, I think, or they're like white women or something like, again, I'm going to botch these statistics, but I remember reading an article saying that like, contrary to other fields, the mental health field is majority women, which was very fascinating to me. And it just sort of highlighted a need for representation for men to be able to talk about mental health. Now, again, this is from an outsider. I identify as a cis woman. So I want to highlight my lack of knowledge of the male and man experience or masculine experience there. But the Proud Asian Men's mission is to sort of unpack masculinity and its role in men's mental health, and how can we sort of reprogram what masculinity looks like to be empathetic and compassionate towards one another. You know, the mental health crisis for men is very real, and it can be super difficult to talk about. And so, you know, the specific offering is to hold a space that is led by men to be able to discuss mental health in a as safe as possible way. You know, there, of course, it's a bit of a work in progress, and I appreciate you calling out, you know, Asian Mental Health Project in and of itself. It acknowledges that mental health and this space is a work in progress there. Yeah, so, you know, we really wanted to specifically offer this space because of the, you know, lack of resources for Asian men and the lack of spaces there. You know, I don't think there are too many, and I hope that there are more, you know, along with Proud Asian Men. And I know there are more, which is so exciting. And so, you know, hopefully spaces like these can serve as a sort of blueprint or ripple effect to offer more spaces for men to feel safe in being vulnerable and talking about their mental health. Because it is a very large issue that I think, you know, requires more representation than there is now.
Yeah, super agree. I wanted to talk about it because, you know, I had a patient several years ago. He was an Asian man and he was going through a lot. And outside of the surgery that he just had, there's just so many things going on in his family. And I remember it was like 2 a.m. in the morning. We were just talking and he started to cry, you know, as he was telling his story. The first thing he did was he took the tissue at the bedside table. Mm-hmm. But he's just like, oh, I'm so sorry that she had to see a man like me cry. And I think that raises up a lot of thoughts, right? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like especially in the Asian community, right? In the Asian collective, especially, I guess, back home, right? Especially for immigrants who came here too, right? So many men had to go through so much. I feel like they don't have felt like they had the permission to cry, right? Yeah. I feel like they're stigmatized to see men, as we're talking about, specifically Asian men, like to have feelings, right? To show those feelings. So I am so happy and glad that you have a bi-weekly session, Proud Asian Men, right?
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I mean, that. Thank you for calling that. What we've noticed, you know, we do a little bit of work with Seniors Fight Back, and they're really awesome. Organization that works with senior citizens and things. And what we've noticed is that, you know, when there is distress in older Asian men specifically, they don't talk about the distress that is, you know, like they don't talk about their own mental health and emotional stress. It's not really about their feelings. It's like, you know, they talk about the physical impact of that. Like my head hurts. I remember when my dad got really agitated, he would say like, I'm just getting numb. I'm getting hungry, you know, things like that. It was so much easier to approach discomfort from the framework of one, like control, but two, like physical ailments, than it was to say, hey, I'm actually feeling sad and lonely right now. And because it's so heavily stigmatized to talk about feelings with men, and there's that expectation to be a sole provider and therefore you cannot budge, and you know, you have to be the stoic sort of figure. And you know, I think that can be very hurtful. And you know, I'm hoping that groups like Proud Asian Men and also you and people talking about this more within, you know, men and masculine communities, we'd be able to destigmatize mental health and, you know, further that mission as well.
Yeah, I wanted to pick on the word that you used, stoic. It just reminds me because I read there are several articles recently from the Medical Association where they're calling out racial bias in medical textbooks and medical exams. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've seen this from my own eyes, reading my own health textbooks and nursing exams. Mm-hmm. Usually exams would use a word to explain a specific racial group. Mm-hmm. And stoic would always be used for the Asian patient, right? And it just goes to show that there's this known barrier between the Asian community and trying to be very expressive with how they feel, right? That's why it's like stoic. I remember an exam actually for my medical surgical exam where it says, there's an Asian patient. What would you say would be the most expected facial expression you'll see from this patient? And the correct answer would be stoic, right? Yeah. So it just goes to show that there's really a lot to unpack and a lot to work on when it comes to trying to move away from the identity of stoicism, right, that others place on us, into something where we can express more and we can advocate more for our feelings for others, which I love that you do through Asian Mental Health Project. Well, you know, you've built such an amazing community, such amazing programs that gives life-changing and life-saving resources. How do you optimize or practice your own mental health now?
Yeah, I mean, thank you. That is such, I could unpack like you unpacking stoicism and like not being able to show on your face, like how to express things is like unearthing so much about like how that translates to like emotional neglect. There's so much to unpack there. Neglecting our means of expressing our feelings and not honoring our feelings is emotional neglect, and therefore that contributes to trauma. Boom, yeah. So many things. But how do I take care of my mental health? Great question. Well, let me be very transparent on my mental health journey at this point. I've been going to therapy for like on and off for like 7 years. So I still go to my therapist, and she's amazing. And that is one key pillar of my mental health care on a day-to-day basis. You know, it can be difficult like to constantly think about mental health and constantly prioritize myself and prioritize my care is something that, you know, I have to like really remind myself to do. I think when we think about like self-care, the first thing that I think about is checking in on how I feel like at this moment. Like, am I feeling sad? Like, what am I needing? Mm-hmm. And that's like the number one, like best thing I can do for my mental health is not necessarily going directly to a coping mechanism, but better understanding like where I'm at the moment. Recently, I've had issues like regulating my own mental health. So, you know, very quite transparently, I've also restarted medication. So that has helped me cope with my own anxiety. And that's just one of the tools that I use. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I also know like to having tuned into my body, I feel like I know that being outside makes me feel good. Doing some sort of physical movement throughout the day makes me feel good. Resting my eyes more makes me feel good as well. So I just try to lean into those things that feel really like aligned with what my body and my mind want. Mm-hmm. And that is sort of my best like tip for self-care is like mapping out what makes me feel comfortable and good and most aligned and most at peace and going forward and doing that. So whether that is like shutting off the computer and just like laying down for like 10 minutes and like doing a little reset, or if it's like going to therapy and taking my necessary medication, you know, those are a lot of ways that I, you know, manage my mental health. And one thing I tend to do is I spread myself very thin, and I, you know, tend to people please a lot. So one thing that part of my self-care journey now is to unlearn that behavior, or actually this is a really great podcast called the Inner Child Podcast. Host, yeah, she's awesome. Host said, instead of like thinking about like omitting like other folks and people pleasing, like add yourself back into the equation. So what I'm trying to do now is like, how can I consciously add my desires and my wants into the equation as well? So these are more like abstract things for self-care. Like it's, oh, I also have been gua sha-ing. It's been She's, it's a great, yeah.
I love it.
So nice. I'm like feeling more snatched, but also like, it's like really like a good way to like tune in with like my senses of like touch and stuff. So that's been great.
I love it. You know, yeah, I mean, I keep going back to the event. It's so historical. But in the event of this, Dr. Jenny Wang was like, we have to create that step from just reading things online to actually practicing that mental health, right? And all of those are, you know, amazing, amazing ways to practice your own mental health, right? And given your own experiences, and I know you hear so many experiences of others through Asian Mental Health Project and all of your check-ins and the people you meet. As the founder of Asian Mental Health Project, what do you think would be your message to someone, especially within our community, who may feel so alone in the darkest bit of their lives and does not know what to do next to rise up again?
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing. I think there's the quote, "This too shall pass." Is that biblical? I don't know. I'm not religious, but but that has really helped me, because I think in the moment of experiencing, whether you're a crisis or just any sort of emotion, understanding that it is something that can be and needs to be felt, but it can and will pass too. Like, there are better times coming, and, you know, not everything has that sort of permanence and doom that, you know, I often, you know, felt. I think at my loneliest point, I feel like there is, you know, nothing else left there. But time and time again, I prove myself wrong with that. And there is always another side. Like, this too, the wave will pass as well. I think any practical advice that I have would be to, I don't want to say just, you know, go to therapy, because again, it's not necessarily accessible for everyone, but if you can and have been considering therapy, take the call, you know, take the first few like consultation calls. calls, talk to some therapists, and, you know, give yourself a set of goals and intentions with that. And it can be as simple as like, I feel stressed, can you help me? You know, like things like that. Yeah, take those initial calls. I think it can only really help to do that. And you don't have to do it alone. A lot of us are doing that alongside with you. And for those who are looking to expand their resources or wanting to get involved, you know, I think it is so important and wonderful to see folks like start their own groups and things and be able to take initiative there. I think it's such a good time to be connected within the community. So whether it's showing up at a group or finding, you know, free resources somewhere and going to those, I think it's so important to be with one another and gather. And yeah, That's my advice. Those are my two cents.
I love all of that. Carrie, you built such a beautiful and powerful and, again, life-changing and life-saving thing. And it's such an honor to sit down with you today and to speak all about it. So thank you so much for joining me today.
You're amazing. Yeah. Thank you. And thanks for all you do. Wow. I think, you know, your work is awesome. I've definitely been following you since we did the Clove. Also, so comfortable. So, thank you for holding this space and for elevating these really important issues in healthcare. Yeah.
And thank you for being part of it. I'll see you again. I'll see you in LA. Bye.
Oh, yes.
In this world of social media that places so much physical critique and pressure on maintaining a youthful appearance against all environmental odds, the skincare and beauty industries have succumbed to a myriad of anti-aging practices. However, the covert fact is that beauty is timeless and that aging is a privilege. Regents, an inclusive wellness brand, seeks to promote this ritual of well-aging, understanding that it is connectivity with the body and attentive care given to it as it changes, including our skin. Founded by Filipino-American Gilio Rizzio, Regents introduces the all-encompassing serum, created to target the concerns of maturing melanated skin by utilizing a blend of healing botanicals used by our ancestors and select clinically proven active ingredients. From the brightening Ayurvedic licorice root to the soothing Centella asiatica and hydrating green algae, welcome to the journey of fueling skin health and enhancing, not changing, your natural shade. With the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ, you can get 15% off your first order on regentswellness.com. Experience the power of mixing native wisdom with modern day science. Do you have any guilty pleasures? I have one. Boba. Given that the average cafe-made milk tea has over 100 calories per serving, over 20 grams of high glycemic sugar, and is packed with artificial flavors, I am so glad that the guilty days are over with Twirl, the world's first canned plant-based milk tea. With only 45 to 50 calories per serving and containing 6 to 7 grams of low glycemic sweeteners, Twirl is made with pea milk, the most sustainable plant-based milk on the market, regenerating the soil where it comes from. Fair trade and organic are the names of the game, as the teas are sourced from biodiverse family farms in China, Japan, and Taiwan that practice sustainable farming techniques. No artificial flavors are ever used. From 4 different flavors to ready-to-eat plant-based konjac and boba pearls, let's enjoy tasty, creamy, shelf-stable, and healthy milk tea together for 10% off using the code FRANZ10, that's FRANZ10, on twirlmilktea.com. Twirl around in its goodness. Growing up, I was ashamed of my Asian heritage. Classmates would comment about the lunch my grandma cooked. Other kids would make fun of my eyes, and even some adults today would tell me to go back to where I came from. But where do I really belong? Who really am I? Am I not American enough? Highlighting the year of the first documented arrival of Asian Americans in North America, 1587 Sneakers seeks to shine the spotlight on Asian American stories and demonstrate to the world the extraordinary breadth of our passions and achievements. Made with full-grain natural Italian leather by footwear artisans, 100% biodegradable natural rubber outsole, calf leather interior lining for comfort and good smells, and wax cotton laces for longer lasting cleanliness. These premium sneakers combine the highest quality, an array of timeless designs, and the movement to be authentically who you are. With the code FRANZ15, that's lowercase FRANZ15, you can get 15% off your first order on 1587sneakers.com. Step into embracing your identity without hiding.
express yourself unapologetically.
Hello.
Excited. It's not every day that we get to talk about this topic, so we're really excited.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important topic, and I think one that's not really talked and dissected much about. And I know that July is Minority Mental Health Month, which I found out recently from your page. So I was like, this is perfect. The stars have aligned. And anyways, if you could just first please introduce yourselves to everyone. Thank you so much.
Of course. I'll get started. I'm Nisha Desai. I'm one of the co-founders of Anise Health and the COO. I have been working on this with Alice around early 2021. And a lot of, you know, our passion for working on this comes from our own personal experience and journey through the mental health system as Asian Americans. So I'm happy to dive more into that soon. But yeah, last thing I'll share is I'm second generation South Asian American, and I grew up in Orlando, Florida. And I'll pass it to Alice.
Hey, I'm Alice. I'm the other co-founder. Nisha and I met at business school. We were doing our MBA programs, and we totally bonded over our shared passion for mental health. And we were both exploring some innovative things to do in the field, and ultimately landed on this problem that we have both felt personally and seen it affect our close friends and family. And it was really just something that we felt so passionate about, and are now fortunate to be able to actually working on this.
Yes, I love it. And also everyone, business school at Harvard. Anyways, now that we said that, well, thank you so much again for joining me. I met Nisha probably a month ago at the Asian Founded event. Time is just flying. But I have heard of Anise, I think last year during Mixed Asian Media's festival, if I remember correctly. I wasn't able to attend the session, but our dear friend Alex Chester Iwata has told me so much about Anise Health, and I finally had the pleasure of meeting Nisha a month ago at the Asian Founded events. And now we are here. And we are here to talk about very important conversations, and conversations that sometimes people may not be comfortable to talk about, right? It's a lot of an earthing of many personal journeys. And I think that's the first thing I want to delve into. When I started this podcast series and I talked to many clinicians and scientists, one of the things I like asking is why they do the things they do. Because I think a person's upbringing or their experiences says a lot of why they choose the things they do in life, all right? Or their career paths or their ventures. And both of you are talking about your personal experiences in the mental health system. And I guess let's talk about that. What are those experiences that led you to a point where you realized, oh, I've experienced this and now I want to open doors for others as well?
Yeah, I'll start. So for me, it really stems all the way back to when I was growing up as a young kid. I grew up in a South Asian household, one that, you know, I had everything I could have ever wanted from really loving parents. But the one part of my personality that I always struggled with was that I was really emotional. I cried a lot. But I also struggled with my own mental health issues that at the time were kind of cast away as being too sensitive, or, you know, I was always just told to be tough and get over it. And that was very much the mindset that I just like deeply internalized for most of my life until college, which was the first time that I started to see people who looked like me around me opening up about their emotions, sharing their stories, and making me realize that like it was okay to not always be okay and to have mental health struggles. And so that was the first time I tried to seek help. I've always struggled with seeking help, probably because of everything I just described, whether it was from a professional or even from my friends and family. It's not something that comes naturally to me. But unfortunately, when I tried seeking help, you know, the campus counseling system was not great, as a lot of campus counseling systems are. It was really hard to get an appointment. And when I finally did, I felt like I was being judged quite a bit and just didn't feel understood by the person that I was talking to, the provider that I was talking to. I stopped, I dropped, I gave up. And honestly, it took me a really long time, years until I started working on Anise to get back into the habit of seeking professional help. But the bigger kind of pivotal moment for me was I wasn't the only one that was going through this on my campus. And there was, unfortunately, a crisis, a mental health crisis on my campus that led to a lot of loss of life. There were 14 suicides during my time in college and the 2 years after. And almost all of those people were people of color. So for me, that was the moment that threw up like major red flags that, you know, something wasn't right. If it wasn't just me, there were people who felt like they either couldn't seek help and left their mental health go untreated for too long, or once they did seek help, just were met with a system that was not built for them. And as a result, felt like there were no alternatives, which should never be the case. So for me, ever since then, I've been dedicating my career to being at this intersection of healthcare and specifically mental health that I'm really passionate about, and business, which is what I studied in undergrad and where I feel like my skills lie, where I can really help create some change. Yeah, Alice has shared a totally different story, so I won't speak for her.
Yeah, well, for me, it also started at a fairly young age. Back in high school, a really close friend of mine had suffered from bipolar disorder, which can be fairly disruptive to your daily life if it's untreated. It's characterized by these mood swings when the highs are very high and lows are very low. And up until that point, I didn't even know what, you know, mental health was, or that anyone could have those issues. So that was a very hard way for me to learn about the impact of untreated mental illness on the individual as well as their loved ones. Similar to Nisha, it wasn't something that was talked about at home. I just felt really intrigued and compelled to be able to help someone who was going through the same struggle. So I went on to study neuroscience in undergrad and was on this path to becoming a clinician, but noticed so much systemic barriers for people to come into care and stick with care, ultimately get better. Saw myself drawn to working on that side of the problem, which led me to work across various business roles in healthcare and consulting and then in private equity. During those times, I have witnessed so many colleagues suffer from just leaving their mental health untreated or unmanaged. Basically, what I would see at workplace is people would come in super motivated to learn, but they would get burnt out within a year or two and move on to a new job. And during this time, you're just pushing till you no longer can anymore. But those have lasting effects for some people. There's real, you know, physical consequences that I have seen my friends suffer through. So I feel like it's something that I have always seen in people around me. But for myself, I actually didn't seek therapy until I started at business school. It was a point in my life characterized by many transitions from working to coming back to school and then moving across the world. I was working and living in Japan before coming to business school. And so it was a lot. And then COVID hit, of course. So I sought therapy for the first time. And I thought I was an expert on this topic. And it was just like, okay, let's get in there, like, get this over with and be done with it. But I actually really, really struggled to find a therapist that I found helpful. I actually had to go through multiple therapists. And despite, you know, me explaining my upbringing and where I thought my difficulties were coming from, I never seemed to get the solution that had a lasting impact in my life. So it's just fueled by so many of my life experiences that I'm building at ease now.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing from both of you. I mean, different journeys and different stories. But I think one of the baseline concepts and essences that we're getting out of this is there's really a flaw in the system, right? Especially within the mental health space. And I think that transcends any ethnicity or race or socioeconomic status. And it's so sad because obviously there's physical diseases that we know of, that we all know, like cancer, heart disease, but also mental health illnesses. It's physical health, right? It's something that, for some reason, I feel like society has divided both of them. There's a chasm between the two. And coming from a Filipino household, predominantly Filipino household, I think I also had a very loving, supporting mom, but I've seen it within like the culture itself. And I think this is very common in Asian cultures, right? I just wanted to share, there was, I think a few years ago, there's a noontime show in the Philippines, which has been going on for like 30 years. And what they do is they go into different provinces and they interview like the local people there. And there was one episode where I think someone was a teenager and she was sharing on live television that, oh, you know, I've been having mental health problems and depression. And one of the co-hosts said, oh, depression, that's just a rich man's disease, right? And so I guess there's this really fallible and a lot of fallacies and myths and misinformation when it comes to mental health, right? A lot of stereotypes and stigma and taboo. And I think it's because it's not really talked about, right? When things are not talked about, when things are repressed and kept hidden under a rug, right? Lots of myths and misinformation and hurtful and offensive comments come out. And I think that's one of our goals today, is to really break down that narrative and try to navigate the way that maybe what's the next steps that we can take, right? And we said that July is Minority Mental Health Month. And I wanted to really veer into, I guess, the space where the three of us can really identify with is within the Asian American sphere, right? Yeah. Like I said, I feel like especially for Asian Americans and especially immigrant Asian American households, mental health is kind of like a very sensitive topic, right? I mean, sometimes too with my mom, I don't know if she's watching, she's not watching. But sometimes like, should I say it this way? And I think that's something that we also experience growing up, right? For you both, what do you think are very culturally specific or race specific mental health issues that we have seen, or if we have data on, that Asian Americans and Asians as a whole experience?
Totally. Everything you just said is like both fascinating, but also things that we've heard so many times. And so it's like, yeah, what can we do to change that narrative? And that's what we're trying to do every day. To your question about culturally specific issues, I think the first point that I want to make is just obviously every individual is different. And we like at Anise and in generally with culturally specific care, the goal is never to stereotype or generalize. The goal is to really individualize the care to the person, and all of the clinicians undergo training to understand how to be culturally sensitive, just to know how to ask the right questions, to not be judgmental, to suggest strategies that fit into your value sets. So that's point one. But that being said, there are a lot of stressors that we see commonly in Asian Americans that it doesn't hurt to educate each other on and to make sure our clinicians are trained to understand how to treat those issues. So a couple that come to mind, and I'll talk about them as quickly as possible for the sake of time, are racism and just generally dealing with microaggressions or discrimination, perhaps even in the workplace. And then two is this concept of like model minority myth and all the issues that come along with that. So on the racism and microaggression front, you know, they're obviously that topic is more commonly talked about these days ever since the pandemic. Unfortunately, we saw like over 300% rise in anti-Asian violence since 2020. And, you know, that's not obviously the full picture of the number of incidents that are reported. So the problem is much bigger. And that has a massive impact on our mental health. There's a stat that we like to share that people who experience discrimination, whether it's like overtly like physical violence or microaggressions, are 2 times more likely to report current symptoms of anxiety or depression. So it's a very real correlation, but this like experience doesn't necessarily, isn't a new phenomenon. It's something that has existed for years in this country. You know, there's like the Chinese Exclusion Act was one of a kind. There's a lot of like bigotry, hatred around 9/11 that eventually internalizes within the individual and makes them feel very alone, makes them feel almost like a perpetual foreigner within this country, and requires specialized support in order to break down what some of those very internalized fears might be. And then on the model minority side, very familiar to probably all of us Asians in this room, but there's this claim, and very false claim, it's a myth, that all Asian Americans are smart, successful, educated, well off. And as a result, it can make our mental health needs feel very invisible. It can make even the solution that we're building seem unwarranted. We've gotten a comment from some people that we've talked to who aren't a part of the Asian community that's like, why do Asian people need specialized mental health support, right? Like comments like that, where people just don't, they think like racism or experiences lived by the Asian American community are not as bad as other marginalized groups. And that comment is just so dangerous, because we shouldn't be comparing experiences across groups. Mm-hmm. We should all be allies and supporting each other and lifting each other's voices up. But a lot of Asians do end up feeling this intense pressure to achieve, to constantly be, you know, like these perfectionistic tendencies, and to live up to expectations, whether it's of their parents or of society, that can, again, cause a lot of people to feel stress, anxiety, but also to just feel very alone. And so those are like just a couple examples of things that we try to specialize in at Anise, but there are obviously many other similar types of stressors that we are happy to share more about if there's time. I don't know if you have anything to add. But.
Yeah, expectations are a very double-edged sword, right? And I think sometimes the call is coming from inside the house, where you also mentioned that sometimes it's from our parents, right? It's from our relatives, right? I don't know if you know, but there's a Facebook group called Subtle Asian Mental Health, and it's a subgroup of like Subtle Asian Traits and Subtle Asian Baking, and you see all these anonymous posts from different members, and a recurring conversation is always the concept of generational trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned something about comparison, and I think that's something that we see across the board, especially across TikTok videos that become viral, right? Parents telling their children, and most of the creators, I find it fascinating that there are Asian creators, they're like, mm-hmm. the parents like, the typical, it has become a meme, but the typical, I cross rivers to go to school, and blah, 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 and you can't do this, right? And that's jokingly, as it is, on a surface layer, right? It's a very real experience to many people, right? Especially within an Asian American household, especially for the younger generation, right? For those who may not know, do you have a definition of what generational trauma is? And how do we navigate that, given that it's kind of a power struggle between a child and a parent, right? It's not like a peer-to-peer.
Yeah, you bring up this really critical theme that exists in our community, particularly among the Asian diaspora, those of us who identify as Asian but live in the Western country, and this generational trauma is very real. It's defined as those trauma that's passed on from one generation to another. And there's a lot of studies that have shown it could be a result of genetic differences or genetic disposition that affects your stress response. There's definitely a biological component, but also I think behavioral component. Just think about what our parents have endured to, you know, survive, lift themselves, lift the family up from significant political or economic upheaval. And during all of that time, their mentality was to just keep going. They most likely haven't stopped to take care of their mental health and like process the trauma, right? They've just been looking towards the future, and there's a lot of, I think, anxiety or trauma that have been caused from their experiences that have been unresolved. Mm-hmm. And when people carry those trauma with them, everyone has different ways of coping. I think for my parents, and what we see in a lot of immigrant parents, will cope by placing all of their hopes and dreams onto the next generation. And for us, that has shown up in these high expectations and very strict upbringing and being told, you know, you have to achieve a certain grades or
doctor, lawyer, engineer, top three.
Without really realizing that maybe some of that is also driven by some of our parents' unresolved mental health issues. So I think there's a lot of components. You asked, you know, how do we get past it? First step to start is to acknowledge that it exists. I think it took me a long time to start seeing my parents as humans, not like parents, because the Asian household is so hierarchical and like what your parents say is kind of like an absolute, right? And I think it wasn't until like much later on in my life that I started to process, well, they're only humans too, with their strengths and flaws. So not letting every word that your parents have said to you get to you, and don't internalize all of that, I think, and starting that conversation with perhaps like what it is that they've endured and start to unpack of some of that together as a family.
Yeah, super agree with all of that. Someone told me once that, you know, sometimes probably in the past our parents had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
They had no time to sit down and be like, what am I feeling? Everyone go, right? And you're right, I guess that gets passed on to the next generation. And like we said, this high expectations that just burdens someone, right? And that can be true for also other ethnicities and cultures as well. I mean, we're talking specifically about, you know, the Asian diaspora and Asian Americans. And there's definitely Asian specific issues and concerns that we have talked about, right? And I guess there's also a very specific response to the way we navigate those things, right? When we talk about seeking help, stuff like that. You posted something on your page, I think a few weeks ago, where it says that the data shows that 25% of Asian American adults with mental illnesses report seeking professional help compared to 52%, so less. Why do you think there's such a disparity between this response to mental health treatment, or at least like at the baseline, seeking help? What is it about Asian Americans that we're kind of like, I don't think I need mental health help?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to what you alluded to at the beginning of this conversation, which is stigma. There are other reasons why people don't seek help, which I'll touch on at the end, but stigma is one of the biggest components of why there's such underutilization. In fact, a statistic that you shared is more interesting when you realize and you compare against other groups that Asian Americans are actually the least likely to seek health services, so the most underutilizing group. So it's a really big issue. And the stigma, I think, stems specifically within the Asian culture from the fact that we are like inherently a collectivist society. Family dynamics really matter. The community and what they think matters, because technicalities, right, like communal harmony means like individual harmony in our culture. Now, obviously, a lot of that is changing as people become acculturated and assimilated into Western cultures. And so the narrative around seeking mental health support is changing. And so there, I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, like things are definitely trending in a positive direction. And the tailwinds in the past 3 years since the pandemic started have been tremendous, especially in like our generation. But I think because of that collectivist like upbringing and some of those undertones, it can be really easy to want to shy away from seeking help or talking about it because you want to quote unquote like save face. There's a lot of shame and guilt in our communities when you feel like you're letting down others, and there's not enough self-promotion or focus on like what it means to prioritize yourself, even if it comes at the expense of others. So I think that is a big reason why there's like a lower rate of seeking help, and also a reason why there's a lot of like somatization, or basically like seeing physical symptoms or like explaining other things away without a focus on the actual underlying mental health reason for your symptoms. So I think that's one thing. And then there are other barriers that preclude people from seeking help within the community. Things like language also can be really intimidating, especially for older generations when your English might not be as strong. It can be scary to talk to a provider. There's also a lot of mistrust with the healthcare system because there is provider bias and there is underdiagnosis or misdiagnosis that people have felt. And so they're kind of scared to go back to try to see someone and seek professional support. So there's a lot of confounding reasons, but my take is that a lot of it stems from that lack of comfort or lack of awareness due to stigma.
It's almost like a new skill that we're having to learn because it wasn't modeled after by our parents. In fact, it was either dismissed or actively been told to not do it because it would bring shame to the family or, you know, fear of confidentiality and impacting your school or work prospects. So it's like something we're unlearning. And then, yeah, that takes a little bit of time. But I definitely see the landscape shifting.
Yeah. So I agree with that. I think there's that classic, what do people say, right? I remember when I was in high school and I was having so much anxiety, I was like, should I seek help? But the first thing that came to my mind was not even about me. I was like, wait, what do other people think? Can I see this? If I see that, right? And I agree with the whole collectivist mindset, right? It's like a chain reaction, right? Like what you do, it's just like a domino effect on the rest. I feel like there's this version of the whole Asian community will know about it. You know, the whole Asian community will talk about it, right? And definitely there's a lot of barriers into not just receiving care in itself, but just seeking it in the first center. Like you said, there's the stigma, it's taboo. There's also the language barriers. And outside of that, I think there's a lot of systemic barriers, right? It's so hard to find a therapist too, right? I feel like there's schedules for, oh, they're not going to see me until 3 months later. It's like, hello, I'm having a breakdown now, you know, stuff like that. And I think the mixture of those societal issues and flaws or untalked about conversations and systemic barriers all just mixes up into this big ball of what do we do now, right? And I think that's where you two collectively creating this platform, this service, it's just so beautiful, right? When Alex first told me about it, I was like, oh, it's very interesting because I feel like this is the first of its kind, specifically also for Asian Americans, right? And I guess I want to veer more into that, into your journey into that. What is Anise Help all about?
Yeah, so Anise is a culturally responsive digital mental health platform, building the gold standard of care for Asian Americans and for people of color. So what we're trying to do here, Anise, is reimagine the mental health care with culture in mind at every step. We know from data that actually 50% of people of color will drop out of therapy after just the first session. And when, you know, you don't continue with care, you don't get better. And we've worked with psychologists and psychiatrists all across the country who are experts in looking at how do we adapt the interventions, which have been largely developed in the West for Western people, to be more compatible with people who don't share those cultural values. And today we've seen really exciting outcomes and feedback from our patients and providers saying, you know, they've lost hope in therapy before, but Anise has really made them regain hope in the process. And we're seeing great engagement. People are continuing their care. They're feeling really heard and understood by their providers and ultimately improving in their symptoms of depression, anxiety, and stress. So to break down a few components of what makes Anise different, first, we've made the therapy process much more action-oriented and solution-focused because as Asians, that's our mindset. I don't think we can change it now. And there's actually studies showing that we respond much better to these types of more problem-solving oriented therapy. So what we've done is integrate therapy with coaching. So coaches act kind of as like your personal trainer, but in mental health to help you do the reps, do the practice, and experiment with the strategies that you talk about with your therapists who are the experts leading the care plan. So there's this holistic care that you don't get by just going to a single provider, including access to our digital resource library, which again has been tailored just for the Asian American community. So there's resources talking about common problems and challenges and how to overcome pressures like perfectionism, people-pleasing tendencies, guilt and shame from setting boundaries with your family, all of those resources are tailored to be used in conjunction with your one-on-one therapy and coaching to make progress. So there's really a proven outcomes that have been seen from our clients in our high quality care. So
yeah, and I'll add on, we're a telehealth only platform at the moment, but we really pride ourselves in our technology and how we feel that technology can play a really critical role in improving the experience. So we do have a digital platform that enables all of what Alice described to kind of come to life in a way that's really easy. And it also helps to personalize not just the care plans, but also the resources, the provider recommendations, and to help triage people to the right setting of care based on progress measurement. So there's a lot of data that's being shared back to the patient as well as the provider to ensure that the care plan is constantly being iterated against to really drive results. And this isn't something that is as standard or common in kind of like private practice settings. So yeah, we're really excited about that as well. And I guess last piece that's really unique to us is just our provider network and how curated it is. They undergo training with Anise and they are really well equipped to deliver a consistent high quality experience, which is not something that you'll see on other platforms where the quality is much more variable depending on who you get, like who you match with. And so we've gotten a lot of positive reviews from clients who just really appreciate that they didn't have to go through a shopping process to meet with like hundreds of therapists, right? They kind of get our recommendations and they're set. They're like good to go and they feel really seen and understood, as Alice mentioned.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I definitely had my own experience of going through, I guess, an online website looking for, like, I thought it would be counselor. And I'm like, okay, and then there's this filter and then this filter and then this filter. And I still have like 500 recommendations. I'm like, whoa. You know, it's like you're watching, you're trying to look for a movie on Netflix, right? And because there's so many, it's just like, oh, I'm just like, I'm not going to watch anything anymore.
Yeah.
And you get tired at the end. I'm like, oh my goodness. And I guess that's why it's so important. I think at the crux of this too, I think what's important is the training of the person who is giving that help, right? You could be the best therapist in the world, but if you cannot really cater to the culture of the person that you're trying to help, right? Culture is such an integral part of one's identity. And it's the way that we formulate our worldviews, and it's the way that we navigate how to go about certain things, right? And so if I'm talking to someone and they have no idea, like, about the experiences that I identify with, there's kind of that persistent gap in between the provider and also the person as well, right? Well, I was very curious, where did the name Anise come from? Can you tell us the journey to that?
It's gonna shock you when I tell you, but it's a combination of mine and Alice's names. But
I was thinking of that.
But we're not that shallow. There's another reason. The spice anise originates in Asia, and historically, before it was used in cooking, it was also used for medicinal and healing purposes. So yeah, there's a kind of dual reason for that. Yeah,
I love it, and I guess it sticks true to the name, right? Like, the hopefully it provides healing, and I mean, just having support and the ability to speak to someone during tough times and in times where it's like you just don't know what's going on. Like, it's healing to the soul, right? And it's healing, and healing to the soul, it just leads to healing of the body, right? Because it's all interconnected. Like we said, mental health is physical health, right? You cannot really separate the two. Well, I mean, you've obviously built something so wonderful catered to mental health support, and we've talked a lot about mental health the past 40 minutes. But why do you think it's so important that we talk about this? Why is it so important for you to create a service like this?
Yeah. Well, for me, I think it is very personally fulfilling to work on something that I kind of wish I had my whole life and, you know, just didn't exist. So it does give me a lot of fulfillment to work on something that we feel like we hear from every single day from like tens, 20s, 30 people every single day who want something like this and are searching for it, but it just doesn't exist. So that's, you know, that's what drives me every day, is just like feeling like we're solving a real problem and a real need. But in terms of why I think it's important to seek mental health help, I think a lot of it just comes down to feeling less alone, just feeling validated and having someone to share your thoughts with, bounce your thoughts back to you, maybe even help you realize that, you know, you're not the only one going through that struggle can be really uplifting. And rather than treating mental health as like something that you seek help for when something really bad happens, I think building it into your kind of daily routine is very much like working out. It's like you work out every day to try to feel like physically fit. Mm-hmm. Similarly, talking to someone and seeking mental health support can help you stay mentally fit and help you just better understand yourself so that you can live a more authentic life, which is like our mission, to help people live a more authentic and flourishing life. So yeah, it's kind of a vague answer, but it just, there are so many intangible benefits, I think, when you just do build it into your daily life.
You stole my life. Mission. But we're really here to support as many people, empower as many people as we can to live their best lives. And what we see oftentimes within the Asian population is often the hardest question to answer is, what do I want? Who am I? What do I want in life? What do I value? What do I like? What I dislike? And it makes life kind of difficult when you don't have that identity solidified, or you don't feel like you have the authority or power to demand those things, right? As minorities, we feel like we need to achieve certain things to be worthy of XYZ. And we just want to help people with overcoming that kind of mindset to really live happier lives. And I think mental health support is, it's kind of like Nisha said, investing in your physical health. You're investing in yourself so that you could be a happier person, be a better friend, be a better sibling or daughter to your loved ones.
Yeah. And it's life-saving, right? It literally is life-saving. I think like what Alice said earlier, we didn't really have the standard from, I guess, our parents in the previous generation. So it's beautiful that something like a niece can be the gold standard into doing that, right? And I guess as a final question, you know, for future listeners of the podcast episode as well, if there's, or just someone out there, a young Asian American, or not even young, they could be in any age group, and they feel like they're in the darkest moments of their lives, and they don't know what to do next, how to rise up again. What'd be your message for that person?
That you're not alone. Over the past 3 years, we've gone through a lot, and the world continues to turn into a darker, darker place, it seems. And so you're definitely not alone in your struggles. And there is support out there. You don't have to struggle alone. I think that would be my main message. It's normal for us to be struggling. Just look at everything that's happened. And also within the younger population, there was a survey that went out recently, surveyed the Gen Zs, and 75% answered they have depression or anxiety. So the mental health epidemic is really real. And no one should feel ashamed of it, but rather it's something that could be worked on and can be improved with the right support. So hopefully they can get to a point where they can start to have hope in the process to taking more control over their wellness.
Yeah. And I think a tip that I've learned through therapy that works really well is just like realizing you don't need to boil the whole ocean at once. So if you are in a really tough place and you don't know how to come out of it, start small. You know, you can set small goals for yourself that you can reflect on, write them down, so you can see that you've made so much progress over time, even if it seems seemingly small to you in the moment. And similarly, find just like small things, small pockets of happiness that kind of give you energy, because that can start to turn your day around if you prioritize those things, you know, whether it's just going for a walk or taking a deep breath or having an extra glass of water. Like, it can be really small things that just make you feel a little bit more energy, and slowly you can build on that to make bigger life changes. But it doesn't have to all happen at once, and the progress doesn't have to be linear. It can be all over the place.
I love that so much. I mean, it's important to seek help baseline, period, right? But I think it's also very important to seek help that somewhat represents our identity, right? Like, as Asian Americans, someone asked Viola Davis once, like, Why is it so important to have representation? She said that representation is a physical manifestation of your dreams and your hopes and your visions. And it's important to not just have a stereotype or an archetype, but it's important to live that yourself. And thank you for Anise for making that possible for so many, for that physical manifestation, representation of the help that, you know, people need for themselves. So Alice, Anisha, thank you so much for joining me today. It's such a great conversation and so many important things to talk about. And this is not the last we're going to talk at all. So thank you so much for joining.
Thank you too. You know, a lot of what we talked about today was that it's important to talk about these things in order to normalize the concept of mental health support. So I think you're doing really amazing work as well by facilitating conversation on these really important topics. So thank you for having us and for doing what you do.
Of course, Alice, Misha, thank you. I'll see you soon.
Thank you so much. Thanks.